Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is EAL, Eastern Airlines Radio, coming live to you with this breaking news. Dorothy.
An infrastructure committee approved a proposal on Tuesday to separate air traffic control from the FAA and transfer it to a nonprofit corporation over 3 years, according to a report in The Hill. The bill would create a board of directors with the power to impose user fees. However, general aviation users would be exempt from fees. The board's 13 members would include three from the airlines, one each for passenger, cargo, and regional carriers, and one seat each for the GA and business of aviation. Seats would be occupied by government, airports, air traffic controllers, commercial pilots, and two more members chosen by the group. The FAA would retain safety oversight. A bill would be considered on the House floor next month. More on Newsletter Online 2017.
Breaking news. New Fort Lauderdale to London flights will launch July 6th. According to South Florida Business Journal, Fort Lauderdale Airport's new concourse will bring more flights. British Airways next week will begin its first scheduled commercial service from Fort Lauderdale Hollywood International Airport to London's Gatwick Airport. Starting July 6th, the United Kingdom-based airline will operate the new nonstop route Tuesdays, Thursdays, Saturdays, and Sundays. Fort Lauderdale says the new service connects Broward to not just London, but more than 150 destinations around the world. See more on Newsletter Online 2017.
Breaking news. BVI Airways to launch Miami's first ever Tortola-Miami route. Miami International Airport on July 22nd will begin service to its 40th Caribbean destination when BVI Airways launches its route to Tortola, British Virgin Islands. It will be the major airport's first ever flight path to BVI's capital island. Miami-Dade Aviation Director Emilio Gonzalez said in a quote, "The Tortola route enforces the position as the gateway of the Americas." With more flights to Latin America and the Caribbean than any other U.S. airport. You can see more of this in the newsletter of 2017.
Miami, Fort Lauderdale. How they compare to America's best-run airports by Edmund Reeser. The international airport in Miami and Fort Lauderdale are separated only by 30 miles. They couldn't be farther apart than if they came to their relative strength according to the American Citizen's Business Journal's analysis. Miami International Airport is number 7, best-run airport in America, outpacing Fort Lauderdale-Hollywood International Airport as number 52. The best-run analysis weighted productivity growth metrics, including revenue per employee, operating income per employee, overall growth rate in the past 5 years. But in a separate ranking, looking at amenities and conveniences, Fort Lauderdale soared ahead, receiving a grade of B+, while Miami received a C+. See the reasons why in the ranking chart and newsletter online 2017.
Hello, Eastern family. It's time for the radio voice of Eastern Airlines. We are heard in many areas around the U.S. and listened to in over 40 countries around the world. We're adding news items as breaking news, which you just heard for at the beginning of our show. We want you to give your thoughts about this change in our broadcast format. My name is Neil Holland, and I'm standing in for Jim Hart, our regular opening announcer. And along with our other host all over the country, we're glad you're with us tonight. This show is for you and about the Eastern family and Eastern Airlines. I like to call it our kitchen table radio. Just as a reminder about how to go about signing in to the show and calling in if you have comments or want to join the host, here's all you need to do. Just go to www.ealradioshow.com and look for the radio icon on the homepage. Click the arrow in the center at 7 p.m. and you can listen on your computer, or you can use your phone, or you can go to our provider for our radio show. That's blogtalkradio.com/Captain Eddie, CaptainEddie. And as I mentioned, this site is the site of our provider, Blog Talk Radio. Now, here's an easier way. Just use your cell phone or your landline. Just call in 213, area code 213-816-1611 at 7 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, and you can listen right on your phone, and you'll be right there, and you'll appear on my producer's board. So all you need to do to join the conversation is just say hello or hi, since you're already on your phone. We want to hear from you. So let's get this episode in the air with a new Eastern airplane, the Lockheed L-1011 TriStar Whisperliner. So here we go. Well, let's get into our program tonight. We're going to celebrate early, just one day early, of the birthday of our great country, the United States of America. So we're going to start off by playing this beautiful song that only John Philip Sousa could do justice to.
John Philip Sousa led the Marine Band to new heights of popularity during his tenure as leader from 1880 to 1892. It was during this era that he earned the title the March King, a well-deserved nickname that continues to this day. Of the 136 marches he composed, one has stood out above all the rest. It was composed in 1896 as Sousa sailed back home from a long European vacation. The inspiration for this march was born of a combination of homesickness, fond memories of his time as leader of the Marine Band, and his stirring recollection of the American flag flying over the White House. The resulting march became his best-known work, and in 1987, it officially became our national march, the Stars and Stripes Forever.
America's birthday, tomorrow, July 4th, millions of Americans will gather to celebrate the anniversary of the birth of our nation for our biggest national holiday. Independence Day celebrates the day U.S. secured independence from British Empire after the Revolutionary War. It falls on the 4th of July every year. Great Britain's 13 North American colonies fought to separate themselves from the U.K. United Kingdom and rule by King George III. These East Coast colonies were New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island, New York,
Yay.
New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Delaware, Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia. They went on to become the United States of America, signing the Declaration of Independence on the 4th of July, 1776, although fighting did continue for some time after that. The American forces led by George Washington were supported with arms and supplies from France and Spain, thanks to the diplomatic efforts by Thomas Jefferson.
The relationship between the settlers and the British had become optimal. However, tensions started to escalate over the imposition of British laws and taxes. No taxation without representation became the cry around 1765, after a rise in Britain's national debt forced the colonists to raise import tariffs and crack down on smuggling to raise funds. There was also a growing sense of nationalism, and it was these largely agricultural communities, acts of American colonists defined, began in the form of rebellious fighting and protest. In 1773, things escalated when patriots in the Boston famously destroyed a shipment of tea by boarding three ships in the Boston Harbor and throwing 342 chests overboard in protest over the Tea Act. This became known as the Boston Tea Party. Colonial government Thomas Hutchinson, 1711 through 1780, escaping from the local rioters after demanding stamp tax for them. It was his refusal to return the British tea ships to Europe with their cargo that led to the Boston Tea Party.
The first celebration was on the 4th of July, 1777, the year after the signing of the Declaration of Independence. 13 gunshots were fired in salute, one for each of the original American colonies, but the Independence Day name wasn't used until 1791. In 1870, it was made an unpaid holiday for federal employees, and in 1938, United States Congress finally made it the paid holiday it is today. These rebellions over taxes led to a full-scale Revolutionary War. Nowadays, the 4th of July is typically marked by patriotic activities, usually outside. Think of parades, camping, barbecues, beers, and fireworks, with as much red, white, and blue as possible, all punctuated with a backing track of the Star-Spangled Banner, Yankee Doodle, and God Bless America. Politicians also like to make a point of appearing at Independence Day celebration and praising the nation's heritage, history, and people. Who celebrates it apart from Americans? The Philippines and Rwanda also observe 4th of July anniversaries for their own reasons. The United States gave the Philippines independence on that day in 1946, and the Rwandan genocide ended with the U.S. help on 4th of July, 1994. Rather more bizarrely, Denmark also celebrates the United States version. It started with European expats in 1911, but now is just an excuse for a nice day out.
Here are some interesting facts. John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, the only two signatory president of the Declaration of Independence to later become president, both died on July 4th, 1826, exactly 50 years after the Declaration was signed. Sorry about that. Presidents own the United States Marine Band recorded John Philip Sousa's march titled The Washington Post on March 3, 2009 in the John Philip Sousa Band Hall at Marine Barracks Annex in Washington, D.C. This video was recorded for the National Museum of the Marine Corps gallery titled A Global Expeditionary Force, 1866 to 1916. This is where the visitors will find an interesting Marine Band exhibit. Now here's the John Sousa Band March called the Washington Post.
What are your plans for tomorrow, host and listeners? That's our presentation of what we know about the 4th of July over the years, and I'd like to get your thoughts about what perhaps stands out as one of the best or memorable 4th of Julys you had. And I'd like to start it off by, first of all, I like to think of good friends. And you know, if we have one or two good friends in our lifetime, I mean really, really good friends. And I think you know what I'm talking about. Well, I had such a friend, and his name was John Cornye. He and I were hired to eat with Eastern Airlines about a week apart, he being a week senior to me. And we met at the apartment complex in Atlanta, Georgia. And we struck it off real quickly. And I heard where he was going to build a house. And by golly, I beat him to it. I went out there and bought a house right before he built his home. And we became friends to the point that we started a little flight school in Atlanta called Georgia Flyers. And John and I did really well with the school, along with the Easterns. We got off increment pay, or onto increment pay, and started to make a little bit of money. But on top of that, we had some funds coming in from our little flight school at Fulton County Airport. But I remember John on July 4th when we owned an airplane, a Stearman, and we did an air show in 1970, and he was going to do one in the afternoon, and it rained him out. And so I told him, I said, well, John, you do the one in 1971. And he did. We did a little air show, one plane air show, because Cumming, Georgia, just north of Atlanta, had an annual old farm equipment celebration on July 4th. The local doctor up there, Dr. Mashburn, still remember his name, had a field that he plowed and kept as a gentleman farmer, I guess, or a doctor farmer. And he allowed all the old steam engines of many, many years ago that did all the harvesting of the crops to be on that field during the celebration of July 4th, and we were invited in 1970 to perform a one-man show along with the old antique equipment there on the field. And John did the one in 1971 in which he crashed and he was killed, and I lost my best friend. So, John, I'm remembering you. July 4th. You were a dear and good friend. Well, that's one thought that I have, and I also have a thought that if you are an airline pilot and if you have ever flown into New York City on July 4th at about 9:30 p.m., and you were given clearance to fly over the Statue of Liberty up the Hudson River and make a right turn at the Central Park, and this is on a VFR day, of course, and to land at LaGuardia. And I had such a flight. And coming up the Hudson River, we were about 2,500 feet, all the skyscrapers appearing on our right-hand side and New Jersey on the left. And I made a remark to the co-pilot. I said, do you see any fireworks coming up your way? And he said, oh, yeah, they're all over New York City. And I said, yeah, they're over here in New Jersey, too. And because every, it seemed like every shopping center or every park had its own firework display on the 4th of July. So what a beautiful, beautiful sight it is to fly a commercial airliner up the Hudson on July 4th at night, on a clear night, and see the displays that the citizens of this great country display for this birthday, our independence from England. So that's two of my thoughts. How about you guys? Can you add to those? Anyone?
Neil, I was just thinking about all the passengers on your airplane that would, they'll never forget that, what you described.
Well, yeah, we've made a cabin announcement also that, look down below us. And it was, we 2,500 over Manhattan is not a very high altitude, considering that the buildings, the tallest, I guess, are just a little over 1,000 feet. So it was quite a display and something I'll remember all of my life.
You know, Neil, last year we stayed in and watched the New York fireworks on the TV. And I got to tell you, in the middle of these fireworks going off, there was this pigeon flying through all that mess, just erratic and up and down. And I just wonder what was on his mind. I mean, this thing was... He was booking, and he was all over the place.
I hate to frighten him.
You might know a pilot would notice a pigeon flying.
Yeah, there you go. I'm opening all the microphones. We've got microphones open, so I've just opened them up, and I see a lot of phones, such as George Jen up in New York, where I just talked about. George, I know you're right there where all the action is tomorrow, and the great celebrations in New York City and Washington, D.C. Do you have any remembrance of a great 4th of July celebration in your area?
Well, actually, where I live, they have their own celebrations here, or they used to build a lot of bonfires right on the beach, and then who was it? I can't think of his last name, a fellow... Dolan, who owned Cablevision, puts on a huge fireworks display, and as does Billy Joel, who lives just down the road here. So I never ventured into Manhattan on New Year's Eve on July 4th, because there was really no reason to. We had our own show right here.
Yeah, and I guess it's out by the Statue of Liberty. Most of the brilliant fireworks are displayed. How about,
they put them on a barge out there.
Yeah. Yeah, we saw that
do.
Too.
When I was sailing, we had a fleet of our boats, 30-foot Catalina boats, and we included some of the power boats in the area. Anyone of them wanted to join us, and we went from Salem, Massachusetts, to the Statue of Liberty dedication for the 4th of July. And we had a wonderful time there. It was absolutely incredible. Boats were everywhere. Fireworks were going off. There were all kinds of boat horns flashing, and it was just absolutely glorious being out in the harbor underneath the statue with all of this going on. I mean, it was just wonderful. Of course, we had a few mishaps during the night, boats that were all anchored there because we couldn't get space in any of the marinas around. My late husband and I tried for months to get a space for all of the boats, and we got some of us in, but some of them didn't, and a lot were in Staten Island. But those of us that stayed on the in the harbor itself, we had all the anchor lines were all tied up. A lot of people had to dive underneath the boat to get the anchors to be untied and freed. And so it was, though the night was great, the next morning was a little bit hectic. But it was wonderful. And then, of course, I've seen many in Boston because I lived in Boston at the time. And at the Boston Harbor Fest, I mean, there's always a great 4th of July celebration. You see those with the Boston Pops every year on TV. And, you know, you have boats that are in the harbor. You have people in the street. You have people that dress like the patriots of years back, and they're walking through the streets, and they have all kinds of parades, and it's really wonderful. It's very exciting, and I loved it. It was great.
Can anybody tell where Dorothy is from?
Yeah.
Say Dorothy, say P-A-R-K.
Park. I know you want me to say pack my car.
Now, I would like to also ask Jim Holder if Jim Holder is on with us. Are you with us, Jim Holder, tonight?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. I was
going to ask
you
to say park
in Georgia.
I got a 4th of July story.
Okay, go ahead, Jim.
Well, it's not a good story, at least from my viewpoint. I was in Air National Guard, Jackson, Mississippi, and we were a photo recon unit flying B-26s, and then they changed our mission to flying C-119 flying boxcars, the air ambulance, aeromedical. So it took all the people in the photo lab, the camera repair and all that. We all had to go to Gunner Air Force Base in the summer of 1958 to go through aeromedical technician school. And it was sort of tough school. You know, it was a big disappointment for us to start being some kind of nurse or something. And 4th of July rolled around, and I was an airman second. The guy named Hayes McCallum, who was my good buddy at the class, he was a airman second. And we went out and ate a late breakfast, and we had great plans to go into Montgomery and go to a movie or do something, you know, just get off base, have some kind of enjoyable 4th of July. We came out of the mess hall, and there was this first lieutenant standing there, and we were in uniform. We had to do that. We were going to change to being clothes, but he spotted us two airmen seconds, and he came over and said, "Guys, I hate to tell you this, but you've just become service." And apparently the base commander was having a big party and invited the mayor of Montgomery and all the men and everybody they could think of to come to this big 4th of July parade and celebration. And me and Hayes not only had to sit there and serve all these people, and, you know, when they came through on the line, dumping potato salad, Coca-Colas, and whatever, we had to do that, but I'll be damned if we didn't have to clean up after it was all over with. And that was the worst 4th of July in my life. Right then, I didn't like being an enlisted guy, and Hayes didn't either. And we ended up getting commissions and all that kind of stuff, and he retired as a 747 captain at Northwest, and I retired as a 727 captain. So I'll never forget that 4th of July.
Golly. Well, Linda Esten is not with us tonight, is he?
No, he's, in fact, he's flying home 4th of July tomorrow.
Okay, all right. Very good, very good. He's a passenger, I would imagine, or is he flying his own airplane? Your own airplane. Yeah.
He's coming home on Southwest.
Okay. We do have some listeners as far as Seattle. Jeff, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm still listening. I don't have any significant 4th of July stories to share. But you guys have some great stories already, that, especially that getting enlisted to serve and then clean up.
Yeah.
But, well, at least I love to eat some of their good food.
Yeah.
Jim, that's where the expression comes in. Somebody's got to do it.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Our turn in the barrel.
There you go. We've got all of our microphones, so any listeners out there would like to comment on their 4th of July and their favorite one would like to hear it now.
Can I go back farther to in our history to George Washington? My daughter is a history major. Maybe you all know this, but George Washington fought, we know, French and Indian War and Revolutionary War, but three horses were killed, shot out from under him, and his jacket had four bullet holes in it, and the Indians actually personally tried to bring him down to the point where years later there was a real old Indian chief who traveled miles and miles. Maybe you know this story. My daughter told me because she's a history major. But the Indian chief wanted to personally meet this man that you could not take down. And they found 80 years after the war, a gold seal on the battlefield that had been shot off of Washington's body, in clothing rather, and didn't pierce his body. So they began to call him the American Achilles because they thought that God had protected him. There was such slaughter around him and point blank range. The officers were dying all around him, but three horses went down and four bullet holes in his clothing. They couldn't bring him down.
I'd never heard that story before.
I never did either.
Well, we live right near Fantasy of Flight, and over there it's only open for certain holidays, but I saw a children's book over there, and they told about it. So that's a good thing to tell the kids.
Yeah.
Also, I saw a children's book that had the story about Eleanor Roosevelt that we're getting into tonight, where she was at dinner, and it sounds like it was spontaneous for her to take that flight, that night flight.
Mm-hmm. Well, excuse me. We do have two parts to our show tonight.
Jumping the gun, but you've got it in here in the script.
Yeah. We have two parts of our show tonight, and we just wanted to start off with a remembrance of the importance of tomorrow. And I hope you all have a wonderful 4th of July. I hope after the radio show I don't have to wait very long to get to my house, because in my little community known as the World Golf Village, the home of the Golf Hall of Fame, they have a celebration of fireworks display. And by the way, we have a fireworks display too at the end of our show. So you stay after the good nights. How fireworks looks on radio. So we hope to entertain you just for a few extra minutes at the end of our show. So stay tuned to that. But I have to wait in line until I can get up to tell them, no, I don't want a ticket to get into the World Golf Village display of fireworks. I live here, so I've got to go all the way through the line going home tonight around 9 o'clock. I guess I usually start off after the radio show. So I did it last year and the year before that. I've lived there about 3 years now. So, but that's okay. I can listen to music and perhaps I can see the fireworks, because I can go out in my street and watch the brilliant display of the fireworks that are displayed during the 4th of July celebration. They celebrate it tonight instead of tomorrow. So I hope in your community you have wonderful displays of fireworks and celebrations of the 4th of July tomorrow. And, of course, if you don't, then television's got it for you. They've got the Washington 4th of July celebration, the New York 4th of July, I suppose, Dorothy. They've got it up in Boston as well.
Boston, and, right.
Boston
Pops.
So, yeah, the Boston Pops. I did, before he died, I did listen to Arthur Fiedler in live performance at the Boston Pops on a layover up there. But at any rate, a wonderful time to remember the importance of July 4th and what we've got being citizens of this great country. And a lot of the things that we do have, we take for granted. So think about tomorrow what you have. So that's our show for the 4th of July. I want to start the next segment by this remarkable speech that was recorded many, many, many years ago. And this is, if I can bring it up here on my turntable. Yeah, here it is. Okay, let's listen to this lady.
Obviously, research regarding technological unemployment is as vital today as further refinement or production of labor-saving and comfort-giving devices. Among all the marvels of modern invention, that with which I am most concerned is, of course, air transportation. Flying is perhaps the most dramatic of recent scientific attainments. In the brief span of 30-odd years, the world has seen an inventor's dream, first materialized by the Wright brothers at Kitty Hawk, become an everyday actuality. Perhaps I'm prejudiced, but to me it seems that no other phase of modern progress contrives to maintain such a brimming measure of romance and beauty coupled with utility as does aviation. Within itself, this industry embraces many of those scientific accomplishments which yesterday seemed fantastic impossibilities. The pilot, winging his way above the earth at 200 miles an hour, talks by radio telephone to ground stations or to other planes in the air. In thick weather, he is guided by radio beam and receives detailed reports of conditions ahead, gleaned through special instruments and new methods of meteorological calculations. He sits behind engines, the reliability of which, measured by yardsticks of the past, is all but unbelievable. I myself still fly a Wasp motor, which has carried me over the North Atlantic, part of the Pacific, to and from Mexico City, and many times across this continent. Aviation, this young modern giant, exemplifies the possible relationship of women and the creations of science. Although women as yet have not taken full advantage of its use and benefits, air travel is as available to them as to men.
Ago, the world lost contact with Amelia Earhart July 2nd, 1937. On May 21st, 1937, record-setting pilot and celebrity Amelia Earhart set out to become the first woman to fly around the world. By July 2nd, she and her navigator, Fred Noonan, had flown 22,000 miles. They intended to make three final but long overwater flights across the Pacific Ocean to complete the voyage, in New Zealand to Howland Island, Howland Island to Hawaii, Hawaii to San Francisco, California,
but instead they disappeared en route to Helen Island. What we know from official U.S. government records, Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan departed LAE, New Guinea, at 10 a.m. local time on July 2nd, 1937, for a 2,556-mile easterly flight to Helen Island. She expected to fly a minimum of 18 hours and to arrive around sunrise. The Coast Guard cutter, Itasca, waited with fuel at Highland Island, which is 2 miles long, 1 mile wide, from 2:45 a.m. to 8:45 a.m. local time on July 2nd across the international dateline. The radio operators received Earhart's intermittent voice messages. Her radio signal strength progressively increased, indicating she was getting closer to Howland. Due to a combination of confused communication plans and the inability of both Earhart and Noonan, they did not know how to use the Morse code, a fact that was not known by the crew of the Itasca. Earhart and the Itasca never made two-way voice or telegraph contact, which would have been very helpful in guiding her to the tiny Howland Island. It appears that she may never have even heard any of Itasca's transmissions. The Itasca received Earhart's strongest radio voice signal at 7:58 a.m., strength of 5+, very good reception. She was circling and searching and running low on fuel. The Itasca received Earhart's last transmission at 8:43 a.m. at a strength of 5, which is still good reception, but then no one heard from Earhart again. Years later, before her 1928 transatlantic flight as a passenger, Earhart wrote a practical farewell note to her sister Muriel in case of tragedy. It became especially poignant after she went missing. She wrote to her sister Muriel, quote, "I have tried to play for a large stake, and if I succeed, all will be well. If I don't, I shall be happy to pop off in the midst of such an adventure." The U.S. government conducted its largest ever search for a lost aircraft from July 2nd to July 18, but found no trace of the crew or the Lockheed Electra aircraft. At first, unsubstantiated radio calls fueled hope that she and Noonan were still alive. Eventually, numerous disappearance theories arose, and they continue to this day. Searches continue as well. But for now, Earhart and Noonan's final resting place remains unknown.
So who was Amelia Earhart? In short, Amelia Earhart was one of the most famous flyers of her day, a record-setting pilot, a promoter of aviation, a media star and celebrity, an inspiring role model for women, and the tragic legend at the center of an enduring mystery. Amelia Earhart gave speeches, interviews, and exhibition flights across the country to promote aviation, as well as women's social and political issues. Here and some of the photographs that are online, she signs the autographs. Her accomplishments and her shortcomings make her worth remembering. Read about them online, exhibition for Pioneers of Flight, or in our brief biography of Earhart. She left a legacy that challenges and inspires. She was not the best pilot, but she had the courage and drive to make another flight or reinvent herself when required. And with the help of George Putnam, she excelled at public relations. Defying gender roles, she built an unorthodox career in a man's world, earned the Distinguished Flying Cross, was a compelling force for aviation and for women's rights, diversified her career with lectures, writing, and business ventures, and consistently made the most admired and best dressed woman list, a complex combination that allowed her to have a real and lasting impact. All told, her flying career, feminism, life and death are subjects of countless books, articles, plays, movies, student essays, ad campaigns, public inquiries, and features like this. Yes, we do want to know what happened to her. Why? Because Amelia Earhart dared to be different.
Amelia's connection with Eastern Airlines. This article is featured in the May-June 1933 issue of the Newswing Eastern Air Transport Newsletter. Just again, her love of flying. Mrs. Franklin D. Roosevelt made a night flight over Washington and Baltimore in 1933 in a Curtiss Condor Eastern Air Transport. She and her party were guests of Amelia Earhart Putnam, including G.H. Roosevelt and the First Lady's brother, George Pullman Putnam, publisher, Mr. and Mrs. Eugene Vidal, and Thomas Doe, president of Eastern Air Transport. Taking off from Washington Airport, the airliner climbed through the skies to 5,000 feet. Amelia Earhart left her distinguished dress in the cabin and took the plane controls, flying it to Baltimore. She returned to the cabin then, and Mrs. Roosevelt sat beside the pilot as he circled Baltimore and turned again towards Washington. It was like looking down from the top of the world. The nation's hostess declared Washington was marvelously beautiful from the air at night, and Baltimore, so huge beneath our wings, was an inspiring sight. Once Mrs. Roosevelt made a pleasure flight at night in a Curtiss Condor of Eastern Air Transport. That time, over New York, she was declared, "It's like a trip through fairyland." Her Washington-Baltimore flight was in a new 1933-type Condor in which the engineering features were included, which makes it the first quiet liner of the air having a noise level of 75 decibels, the same as a Pullman car. The crew was comprised of Chief Pilot E.H. Parker, Co-Pilot Earl Steele, and flying hostess Edwina Davis. Mrs. Roosevelt has made 11 trips by Eastern Air Transport.
That's our presentation of 80 years ago of the loss of communications and the loss of Amelia Earhart and Noonan, her co-pilot or navigator on that flight. And any thoughts about that flight and about Amelia Earhart? I think one person, one of our listeners, emailed me, wanted to know where there's been so much of trying to discover where, which island, and where and parts of the airplane is this part of Amelia's Lockheed Electra and that type of thing. And was there even if she landed, would she have been able to take off again? Had she had fuel, of course, would there have been the possibility of her departing? And, of course, depending upon where she did land, in the ocean or on the shoreline of some island, which I think Howland Island has been identified. But any thoughts out there? I know we've got a whole board of listeners. So speak up.
This is Chuck. I saw a program on this very subject, obviously. And according to this group who had been looking for parts of the airplane for years, that they had found part of the aircraft. It was part of the wing, about 3 or 4 foot square, on another small island, and they found that what they claim is her shoe. So they think that she landed or come to a rest on this small island trying to save her and Noonan. And then over the years, the plane had just slipped off into the deep part of the ocean. I don't know. Has anybody heard any like that?
Well, you know, researching this for our show tonight, I looked up some last communications received by anyone, and there's some interesting stuff out there that you can get on the internet. And this one lady, an elderly lady, she was a teenager at the time, kind of enjoyed using her father's short wave radio. And she was dialing through, and she picked her up, she identified. She said, and she took a log of this or a notebook of the communications that she had heard, and it was Amelia Earhart. And so it was very interesting, and it may have been Amelia Earhart that had transmitted. And even though this person was in a place that was miles in the United States, miles and miles away, because of the broadcast of low band frequency, it did travel, and it did talk about how transmissions were possible to be received thousands of miles away. So it's very interesting to do a little exploration yourself and what's out there about Amelia Earhart.
Well, if anybody wants to know about Howland Island is about, just north of the equator in the central Pacific Ocean and about 1,700 nautical miles southwest of Honolulu. That will give you an idea of where she was in between leaving her departure and to her destination, which was Hawaii.
Remarkable lady in what she did during her lifetime in aviation. And her husband, Putnam, was a publisher. And it was interesting to note that on the Eastern flight, they had a party that included her husband and Eleanor Roosevelt's brother. Or the brother of, I'm sorry, of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, G. Hall Roosevelt, and Eugene Vidal. And, of course, Vidal, I think, was a writer also, but that was, I'm sure, one of the sons of the Mr. and Mrs. Eugene Vidal. Gore Vidal, that's the name I'm trying to think of. And, of course, Thomas Doe was the president of Eastern Air Transport, was on that flight. And Doe was the president right after Pitcairn sold the airline to Clements Key. And Thomas Doe was appointed president of Eastern Air Transport.
Very interesting story, really. Her life was incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, really was. Folks, I've got a report on Mary Block. I got an email from her today, said that she was back about a week ago from her trip on the Lewis Clark Expedition and the little Eastern Flyer, which was a 1960 Shasta travel trailer, 16 foot long, and it was painted in the Eastern colors, and they went all the way to the West Coast and came back. And she had traveled 6,107 miles on that trip. Wow, what a trip. Boy, I tell you what, if I was of the other gender, I would sure join her group because they won't let men enjoy these trips that they take. I guess it was just simply because they want to get out of the house and get away from the kids and the dogs and the husbands, in that order, maybe. And but at any rate, the Sisters on the Fly is the name of the organization that Mary Block is a member of. And I think there are 6,000 plus members of that organization. And they do trips such as Route 66, which he did a couple of years ago, and then they just did the Lewis and Clark Expedition all the way to the West Coast. And she was unable to join us on our program. And she did do some reporting, and we have that. I think Dorothy has entered that on the website. So
right.
I'm glad you made it back, Mary. And we hope to have you on one of our shows and tell us about your adventure out there. And you did send us some pictures back, and I don't know whether Dorothy's got on the website. Maybe she can tell us that she's got a picture or two of that. But
I haven't got any recent ones, but if you received any from Mary, I'd be happy to post them up there along with what we have already. It's listed in under travel, members travel, so everyone can take a look at them. That would be great, Neil, if you have them.
Yeah, I'll email them to you, then you can put them on, post them up there. And I'm sure they'll have a book like they had on Route 66 to Santa Monica. And from Chicago, and that was great trip 2 years ago. And she was able to get in touch with us on Monday nights and gave us some checks along the way as to what was happening. She went through some very terrible weather at that time. There was some really bad weather, but she seems. I think she had some difficulties with her. Vehicle, yeah, and the trailer had an axle problem, but she said with that and all the other things that happened along the way, both good and bad, she'll remember her trip for a lifetime, for the rest of her life. And so it was good that she will, I hope that, I'm sure Mary will join us and tell us about her trip out there. Dorothy, tell us about the website before we.
Well, our show tonight, I do have a video up on in our video section of Amelia Earhart. It's not a long one, but it's nice to see way back then and to see her up getting into these small little airplanes. It's a little exciting when you look at it and think, oh, my God, imagine flying way back when like that. But anyway, that's up on the website, along with information on the next two upcoming episodes that we have. Next week, of course, as you announced previously, is the sound bites of air traffic controllers. That should be very interesting. And the following one will be July 17th. As a matter of fact, the hosts are going to be on vacation that week, so there won't be any on the 17th. And from the Eastern Files as well, there won't be any episodes while Anil is away of the July 6th, 13th, and the 20th on from the Eastern Files. But we'll be back again on July 27th with the Eastern Aircraft at the Smithsonian Institute, and that's going to be a great show about our Pitcairn PA-5 mail wing and the Douglas DC-3. We also have the breaking news that's up there, and just to give you an idea, I pulled some of the statistics on it, and the review of Final Disaster has gotten 119 views on it, so it's quite interesting to read about it. If you'd like to do so, it's under the blog, under our website. We have the calendar, which we update as we go along, and that, too, not only will it show on the front for the first four, but it will keep the whole month or two, so you have the ability to go in there and click on any month and find out what's going on ahead. So that's it for tonight.
Very good.
Very good.
Thank you. Any other comments before we land this airplane? Oh, Jeff Lewis, I hope you'll be able to be with us next Monday when we talk about the funny things that are said between air traffic controllers and the pilots up there. So we hope that you'll be able to give your thoughts about that since you were an air traffic controller. Thanks for listening in tonight. We hope you enjoyed our show, and let's see if we can get this airplane on the ground. And then we've got some great music, especially one that I think you'll really enjoy. So let's land. Let's see if we can get a sound of a landing airplane here. I don't know if it's going to be a 10-11 or just what the heck it's going to be. But we'll see what it is.
Let's try a 10-11.
Sounds like a 10-11, sounds like a 727, sounds like they all sound the same to me, especially when they make that kiss to the runway. Okay, it's great. Great landing, Captain Steve, who flies our airplanes, takes off and lands, Captain Steve Thompson. It's always fun when we talk about Eastern Airlines or the new Eastern Airlines and the place we worked, the stories we share. We feel we've truly earned the title, the radio voice of Eastern Airlines. And it's all because of you, our callers, listeners, guests, hosts, and sponsor, REPA. That's the Retired Eastern Pilots Association. Thank you. We look forward to our Eastern family and friends joining us again in July when we celebrate our we've just celebrated our nation's birthday, which is tomorrow, but we've got some exciting shows coming up very soon. So until then, we all say good night, Eastern.
Good night, Eastern.
We love you.
We love
Eastern.
You.
Good night, Eastern. We
good
love
night,
you,
Eastern.
Eastern.
To the Sleepy Hollow Mountain country, to the swamps in Open Oak, to Guthrie, Oklahoma, to Hibbing, Minnesota, to Grants Pass, Oregon, to Stovepipe Wells, California, from Texas to Montana, from California to Maine. It's a beautiful, spacious sky, the amber waves of grain, the purple, majestic mountains above the fruited plain. In the sunny days of winter snow, from Arizona sand to Cherokee, North Carolina, to Tarpon Springs, Florida. America, it's time to be refreshed, recall to memory. Did not God shed his grace on thee from sea to shining sea? The land is big. The land is free. Sand and surf, grass and tree, from sea to shining sea. As I went walking that river of high, I saw above me that endless skyway. I saw below me that golden valley. I said, this land was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. steps to the sparkling sands of the Diamond Desert.
Good night. That was great.
Thank you.
Loved it.
Bye-bye. Happy 4th.
Bye-bye.